Welcome, 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 beloved listeners, to the Little Wireless program. Today has been one of the most turbulent in our political history, and later on in the program I shall be discussing matters arising with, would you believe, Charles Waterstreet, the inspiration for Rake. And I'm sure, Charlie, you'll have some very profound things to say about it. But first, let's look at the Pistorius trial and gun culture. I've got two very distinguished long-term observers of South Africa. Adele Kirsten has been a non-violent social justice activist for 25 years in South Africa. She's been active in the, or she was active in the anti-apartheid movement in the 70s, and she's still blazing away all these years later, as is R. W. Johnson. Bill, he's a British South African journalist and historian. He was born in England, educated at both Natal and Oxford. And heavens above, Bill wrote How Long Will South Africa Survive in 1977. And much more recently, South Africa's Brave New World, the beloved country since the end of apartheid. And it's marvellous to have them both on the program. Let's get stuck into this. Oscar Pistorius, a gun freak. In fact, his family is said to have owned 55 firearms. And prior to shooting Reeva Steenkamp, Oscar had applied for a license for the world's most powerful handgun. Bill is, as I said, author of many books, including South Africa's Brave New World, and also he's on the blower from Cape Town, and also joining me via Skype, in this case from Manchester, is the aforementioned Adele Kirsten. She's a spokesperson for Gun Free South Africa and the author of A Nation Without Guns, the story of Gun Free South Africa. And Adele says that in many cases, women in South Africa are shot with a legal gun by a man they know very well. Now, Bill, just before the trial, Pistorius had applied for what's known as the world's most powerful handgun, the Smith & Wesson Model 500. How much of a passion did the family have for weapons?
Well, I think they were an old-fashioned gun culture family, and they seem to have been very, very keen on guns. And Oscar had applied, I think, not only for that gun, but for a shotgun and various other things. But he only owned a 9mm Parabellum, actually, pistol. So that was all he actually had, but clearly he had a great appetite for more.
Well, to talk about the gun culture, because it is as powerful in its way in South Africa as it would be in the United States.
Well, I don't think that's any longer true. I think that, in a sense, the gun control people have won here very thoroughly. It's now very difficult to get hold of a gun. I mean, lots and lots of special conditions and licenses and so forth. And Oscar would have found it pretty hard to get those guns he'd applied for. And certainly I know people who've applied for guns and just failed to get them, and I think that's quite common. The people who have guns galore are, of course, the police and the criminals. And there's no doubt at all that guns, you can find them plenty in townships and squatter camps and so on, and you can buy one really quite cheaply on the black market. So in that sense, there are still guns around, but I'm always surprised at how relatively easily the gun control people were allowed to win here, because it was a big gun culture country, and yet they went down without much of a fight, in a way.
Let's welcome Adele now to the discussion. Oscar's father, Adele, said the family owned guns because they could not rely on the police to protect them in a country where crime rates are the highest in the world. 15,000 people murdered in 2012 alone. Does that concur with your observations?
We do post one of the highest, you know, homicide rates in the world. But I think just to take a step back into the gun culture in South Africa is, up until 94, the Arms and Ammunition Act, which was a typical piece of apartheid legislation, privileged whites, making it relatively easy for white South Africans to get a gun. So, for example, the age limit was 16. There was no limit on the number of guns you can own. And that's changed in 2000 with the Firearms Control Act, really raising the bar. But I think one of the threads, if you will, in the gun culture is that under apartheid, for many whites, owning a gun was really to protect themselves against the kind of the external threat, as it were, of communism, of black South Africans. And in some ways, part of what we see playing out in the Pistorius trial is some of that still in the popular imagination, I think, of many whites, that the person actually behind the door, if we take Pistorius' version, was a young black man intent on doing harm. You know. So it remains a key thread, particularly in how white South Africans understand crime, because the reality is the primary victims of crime in South Africa are not white South Africans, it's black South Africans.
Bill, I take your point, and I withdraw my suggestion that South Africa and the United States are have strong parallels, but quite clearly in the United States there is no way that nation is going to give up its guns, with the NRA as the most potent lobby group in the country. Why do you think it did prove so easy to relatively disarm white South Africa?
Well, I think because they were actually being asked to accept an awful lot of other changes at the same time. Some of them were much more serious, you know, things that worried many families was, for example, the integration of education. Now, in fact, that went very smoothly and well on the whole, but a lot of people would be anxious about it when they didn't know what it was going to mean. And, you know, the integration of all social and public facilities and so forth. So all of that came in a rush pretty quickly, and I think that most people were dealing with that and that I did know people who were very, very indignant about losing their guns or not being able to keep what they wanted or buy what they wanted. But generally, they were people who had been keen hunters, because remember, hunting is a big thing here, as in America. And secondly, of course, this thing about personal security. Although I must say, in my own experience, the ownership of a gun does not enhance your personal security. It tends to diminish it.
Adele, were you surprised that you were victorious so easily?
No, I disagree with Bill Johnson. It was a huge struggle. It was a big fight. It wasn't easy. Gun Free South Africa formed in 1994. We started with a big firearms amnesty, and then in the late 90s started looking at legislative reform. The gun lobby or the kind of pro-gun owning fraternity in South Africa is relatively small. There are only 1.8 million licensed gun holders in South Africa, but they are organized and they are vocal and they have a deep attachment to their guns and so feel strongly about any infringement.
But of course, Adele, as I know you've written elsewhere, historically guns were used to dispose of the land from indigenous people, to subjugate local people. And throughout the apartheid era, of course, it was impossible for blacks to have weapons, such weapons.
Yes. It was only in 1983 that special provision was made for black police officers to get a personal sidearm rather than their police-issued sidearm. So it was a tough battle to get stricter gun laws, but I think there was a whole lot of stuff happening globally. I think even in Australia in 1996, post your Port Arthur massacre, I think the Dunblane massacre, there were a number of other sort of international examples where people were able through research, through advocacy, to strengthen national gun laws. So there was a global environment that facilitated that as well. But I think Johnson is really correct in saying that part of the new law was about breaking with our apartheid past. So it was about transforming our society and trying to shift away from seeing the ownership of guns as normal and acceptable.
Bill, Adele is very well informed. Australia did have a huge change in its gun laws after the Port Arthur massacre, and but it was a buyback system. We were paid to hand in our weapons, and people weren't that unhappy because we got a good price. Was there a buyback in South Africa?
No, not as far as I know. I didn't hear of one anyway. And of course, from what Adele says, I mean, you must realise, even on the figures she gives, it's under 4% of the population who own guns legally, whereas, of course, in practice, there is a far wider gun ownership among criminals.
But Bill, I know you've pointed out that many AK-47s were brought in by the ANC, and they still leak over the border from Mozambique. And, of course, as you point out, the police lose, quote-unquote, quite a few weapons, as does the army.
Absolutely. So, I mean, guns continue to circulate. I mean, it's not all that long ago I remember going into a very troubled township in KwaZulu-Natal, and I saw a 12-year-old with a Kalashnikov, and I think he was drugged, actually. I mean, quite scary. And, you know, in that time, I mean, that sort of situation has come down quite a bit since then, thank goodness. But in those days, if you went into those areas, I mean, the people certainly with no gun licenses, but plenty of guns.
Adele, Reeva Steenkamp's father describes Johannesburg as a jungle, one of the toughest places to live. Certainly didn't want his daughter to live there. Is that exaggerating the perils of Johannesburg?
I've been a resident there for over 30 years. It's an amazing city, but it's like any other big city, is that you have to be vigilant. It does have one of the highest homicide rates in the country, but certainly not the highest. Cape Town, the Western Cape area, posts slightly higher than that. But I think it's like many other countries. If you visit there, if you live there, it's day to day, it's not a scary place to live. It's, you know, people go about their normal business. But I want to really talk about the link between legal and illegal, because there's a sense that, you know, where do these illegal weapons come from? And unlike drugs, the majority, 99% of guns are legally manufactured. So they have a legitimacy. There's a manufacturing industry that's recognized as legitimate. And in South Africa, this is really important, because 20,000 guns annually are lost and stolen from civilian owners. So that's what feeds the illegal market. And in fact, in South Africa, the main sources of illegal weapons are that category, and then leakage from state armory, loss and theft from police. And cross-border trade is one source, but it's a really small source. Our problem in South Africa is handguns. 85% of our crime is committed with handguns, not with assault rifles. And so that's why you will see the focus of the Firearms Control Act is really restricting, in fact, limits handgun ownership to one handgun per person for self-defense.
We're talking about gun culture in South Africa. My guests are Bill Johnson and Adele Kirsten. Bill, I know we're going to lose you at any moment. Do you have something you'd like to add to what Adele said?
I'm all right, thanks. Carry on. Well, you know, the only thing I would say, I mean, of course, people like Adele fought quite rightly for gun control, and I personally am very glad that they won. The only thing is that it is still a very unequal situation, in that you do hear all the time of people who nowadays don't own guns being attacked by burglars who do. My next-door neighbors, this happened to not long ago. 9 armed men broke into them, and all with handguns and rifles and so on, and they were lucky to survive. And the point is that crime in this country is very distinctively violent, much more violent than it needs to be, as it were. You know, people often torture or kill while they are burgling, which they don't need to do. And the attacks on farmers continue, and many of them also are by armed men. So that people still do feel very much under threat, and to that extent I can understand and even sympathize with those who want to have personal security through those means. But I just don't believe that it works very well. That I think that, you know, owning a gun, usually it becomes a reason why people want to burgle you, is to get the gun.
Adele, I want a quote from Vanity Fair. A woman is killed by her husband, her boyfriend, or her same-sex partner. It happens every 8 hours, where intimate femicide is the country's leading cause of violent deaths of women. You've carried out plenty of research in this area. What are your findings?
Well, Gun-Free South Africa doesn't do research, but we draw on research, for example, the Medical Research Council, that's their data. They did a 10-year retrospective where in 1999 they did a research on intimate femicide where it was every 6 hours a woman was killed by her intimate partner. And then they looked at the numbers again in 2009 to see what had changed over the last 10 years. And that's where we get the number of 3 women a day being killed by the intimate partner. What's important from a sort of gun control perspective is that over that 10-year period, all other means of killing women, whether it was through knife, strangulation, blunt force injury, had remained static, but there was a significant reduction in the use of guns in intimate femicide. In fact, it had halved. In 1999, 34% of the sample of women were killed with a gun, and in 2009, it had reduced to 17%. And so the researchers suggest and argue that the only variable then was the introduction of stricter gun laws. That's the good news. So despite our high levels of violent crime, in 1994, when Gun-Free South Africa started, we had 35 people a day being killed with a gun. That's reduced to 18. That's significant, but that's still very high. Every single day, 18 people being killed with a gun. So there's a lot more work to be done, but we're beginning to see that stricter gun laws are making a difference.
Bill, many have pointed out an irony of Reva Steenkamp dying at the hands of a man with a gun, because both Reva and her mum were strong advocates for women suffering from abuse. Will the Pistorius trial, whatever its outcome, change how women are treated in South Africa?
I mean, I think that just like this was an old-fashioned gun culture country, it was certainly a very old-fashioned sexist country, and that women were not treated well. I'm afraid that this, at the risk of sounding racist, I mean, black women are the worst treated, undoubtedly, and that hasn't really changed. What we've had in South Africa is the promotion of elite women, middle-class women, MPs, some lawyers, that sort of thing, and therefore it looks good on the indices in terms of feminine equality. But if you look at the daily lives of women in this country, I'm afraid South Africa is still pretty backward.
Adele, one of the fascinating things about your career, and I should point out that you were South Africa's Woman of the Year not so long ago, is that you assisted in establishing, through the National Peace Accord, a rapid response network of unarmed young people who were trained in conflict resolution and emergency services. Is that still operating?
No, that was very much part of the sort of 4 years of our negotiated settlement, where we were trying to integrate some of the self-defense units, young men and women who'd been involved in the sort of informal militia. It was very much a intervention to try and bring some kind of stability to some areas which were experiencing high levels of violence.
Now, Bill, I want to come back to your extraordinary list of books. I mentioned that you wrote How Long Will South Africa Survive in 77 and South Africa's Brave New World in 2009. Are you optimistic about the future of the country that you know very well, or do I detect in your voice a weary pessimism?
Well, there's no doubt that things are degrading now. I don't think anyone really seriously would deny that. And the economy and the country is being very badly mismanaged. I think there's no doubt. And corruption is much, much worse than it used to be. All that is true. Personally, what I expect to happen is that our credit rating will gradually be further downgraded until we go into junk bond status, and that could trigger a debt crisis and possibly an IMF intervention. That is my expectation over the coming 5 years. That's not necessarily a dreadful expectation. Our rate of growth is still higher than almost any European country. It's still a lovely country to live in. I have no intention of moving away. But it's, as the Chinese say, we will always live in interesting times, and that's not necessarily always a nice thing.
Let me put the same question to you, Adele. Are you an optimist about the future of your country?
I like the interesting times. It's not an easy country to live and work in. It's got enormous challenges, and it's a mixed bag. I mean, there've been extraordinary strides post 94, but we have such huge inequality in our country, and I would see that as the single most important challenge to overcome. It's one of the key drivers of violence, and it's a difficult time at the moment. There's a lot of resistance, there's a lot of dissatisfaction, there's a lot of organizing happening sort of more kind of community level. I think this election is going to be really important to see where are the shifts. But I think the next 5 years are going to be critical years for us to see if we can really deal with some of the challenges.
Look, I thank you both very much for your contribution to our little program. I've been talking to journalist Bill Johnson. As I said, Bill's a British South African journalist. I should have also pointed out he was a Rhodes Scholar. And his books include South Africa's Brave New World, The Beloved Country Since the End of Apartheid, published by Alan Lane. Adele Kirsten is, among other things, spokesperson for Gun Free South Africa, and her latest is A Nation Without Guns, the story of Gun Free South Africa, published by Scottsville. And it's been good to talk to you both. This is LNL on RN, and as promised, after a little bit of music, I'm going to welcome into the studio the quite extraordinary Charles Waterstreet. Yes, the real-life inspiration for You Know Who. It's not generally known that there's a new series based on my life, which will soon be screened on the ABC, where I am played by, who am I played by? Someone excitingly glamorous. I can't think of who's going to play me, but it's going to happen. I mention this because sitting opposite me is the rakish Charles Waterstreet, and we're going to discuss Charles's life and times and his interactions with Cleaver Green. First of all, Charles, lovely to see you. Isn't it weird we've never met?
Unbelievable, because we seem to follow the same people, have the same interests, and I read you religiously.
So I read you irreligiously.
But now it is amazing. It's like you run into people you think you never meet, and then you don't run into people you think you would meet.
Well, we're making up for it now, mate. Now, look, we've just been discussing Pistorius. Would you or Cleaver represent him?
I'd give both my arms to represent him. He's given his legs. I would give my arms. It's a case of the century. You don't get many like that. And both the prosecutor and the defender are having the times of their lives, because it's a person who protests innocence, has a fair defence, and you've got glamorous, you know, supporting cast. I mean, you don't get a more beautiful person than a victim, and, you know, more tragedy than a man with a defect.
I think we've witnessed a genuine tragedy today in the downfall of O'Farrell. Let's switch to a local scene. you know, whatever his shortcomings, I don't think he deserved to have his head on a plate or on a pike.
I've forgotten every bottle of drink I've ever gotten from anybody. I mean, the whole thing is just ridiculous. There's been two very innocent victims of ICAC. One was Greiner who set it up. And he was, you know, one of the most honest people you could ever come across. And now Barry O'Farrell, for I don't believe too much in his beliefs, but as a party, but certainly he's straight arrow, and the whole thing is overkill of the First Order.
I've got a strange feeling he may survive, that we haven't seen the last of O'Farrell.
But New South Wales have a history of rum rebellions, but I think not over port.
Okay, now, as I said, this is Charles Water Street. How do you like to be addressed? Charles, Charlie?
Look, I've been Charlie all my life, except to myself. I keep calling myself Charles, but okay. Everyone who knows me calls me Charlie.
I'll call you Charles. Thank because you. I don't really know you yet, but I want to do this. What's it feel like to have yourself writ large on the small screen?
Oh, well, it was fascinating at first to actually see parts of your life on screen and watching it with the director and the actor and so on and so forth. But this year's been especially interesting because I was in New York where Greg Kinnear played the lead in Rake, and really good, and New York was plastered with Rake posters all over the place. And I get off the plane coming back here and all the buses are plastered with Richard.
I have to say that your character is the most lovable on television. Do you find that flattering?
I find that very flattering, especially as Richard goes
out
of his way.
You're not exactly lovable yourself, are you?
No, I'm more roguish, but the more you know me, the less you want to. But Richard is an amazing actor, and although I may have provided the vase, he certainly arranged the flowers.
I understand that the American version thereof has not been as wildly successful as our indigenous one.
4 million viewers is high in my opinion, but it falls between two planks. Because he's an extreme character, you want him to do extreme things, but he's on Fox, which is like free-to-air, and you're competing against things like Breaking Bad and Game of Thrones on cable, where where nudity is compulsory. So if you're on a free-to-air station, you can't have too many extreme conduct that are not family-friendly. But Greg Kinnear's done a fantastic job, and the show's very good, but it's just straddles two worlds. I went to HBO with it, with Charlie Sheen, to do it, when Charlie was really down and out. And I thought that might
have been... How charitable of you.
Well, there was some motive. I wanted to give him a lift up, and I thought he wouldn't even have to act. And he'd have his lines under his nose.
Yeah. Now, you gave up the grog years ago, didn't you?
I did, yeah, 15 years ago.
Why? Under what circumstances? I was talking about Kerry Packer giving it up after the fatal car accident. Why did you give up?
Well, I had to. I didn't realise there was an allotment that you got that many drugs, that much alcohol, and I'd used all mine, and I suddenly came to the realisation I had no more brownie points left. But I was down and out. I was obsessive and compulsive, and my motto was excess and no further. And like many of us, I had to hit rock bottom. I ended up in a hospital for a week. In fact, after litigation with a well-known actress, and that did me in a bit. And I had a son by then, and I didn't want him to see me drunk. But I started 10 years before trying to give up. I was at dinner with Barry Humphreys, and I was drinking Sambucas before dinner. So I'd have five flaming Sambucas before dinner. And he took me aside and said, "Do you know you've got a problem?" And I didn't realize.
Barry's a great drink counter. I've been at dinners with people whose names I won't mention, and it never occurred to me they might have an issue. But Barry counts the drinks.
You know he does.
And later he says so-and-so should be joining me at AA.
No, I don't think it's breaching any faith to say he took me to a meeting. And I certainly, after that, it took me 10 more years to actually give up the grog.
Do you miss it?
Not at all. Not the grog, no. But I took it up originally because I grew up in a pub, and it was part of the, you know, a great Australian tradition to drink.
Excessive. You were brought up in a pub.
My family owned pubs for 100 years. Water Street's Hotel in Albury was next to the railway station. And so those days they had two different gauges for New South Wales and Victoria, and overnight passengers had to get off and stay at our pub. And so we made a lot of money until that backward step of, you know,
of unifying the railway lines.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
It's a terrible, stupid idea.
Yeah, Australia was so much better off.
A Victorian knew who he was. He was 5 foot 1¼ inches, whereas in New South Wales was 4'8". And they're two different types of people.
Where does the humour come from in you, Charles?
I think it's a defence mechanism against that. You know, something. My mother was a bit of an alcoholic and there was a little at home, but mostly because I grew up in the bar and my father was a publican and he was the king of the counter. He was singing at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, with darkened lights because it was illegal. And I think a bit of Irish and a bit of son of a publican, son of a gun, and a lot of hiding under humour.
I think humour is evolution's way of coping with mortality, isn't
it?
Oh,
you can only laugh at it, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's otherwise it's just too grim.
Have you over your longish life been as concerned about mortality as I have?
Well, I've never had a fear of death. In fact, I spent the first half of my life trying to kill myself, but the second half trying to live forever. And you know, I've been to the gym every day since I gave up grog in a vain attempt to, you know, live forever. But mortality is something that always bewitches me because it's so fascinating to understand whether we exist or do not exist at any given point of time. But I must admit on public radio that I've taken an elevating drug recently that does lead me not to fear death. There's a drug called DMT, and it's...
Did you bring some for your interviewer?
I could make it available.
Thanks. We won't... Well, can we edit this bit out? That's very kind of you, Charles.
Yes, no.
I knew I'd like it.
Yeah. No, yes. Did you enjoy that?
Oh, dear. So Albury Wodonga, the Twains.
Oh, no, it was a city, you know, it was ruled by a man called Cleaver Bunton, and that's where Richard and I came up with the name of the character, Cleaver Green. Cleaver Bunton was Albury's mayor for 30 big years, and Albury was the centre of the earth, as you would know.
Absolutely.
When Richard and I were children, Cleaver Bunton was like a colossus bestriding Wodonga and Albury, and he became a senator when Lionel Murphy went to the High Court as a political neuter. And I think he was one of the world's most political neutral people in the world.
Richard Roxburgh is also an Albury Wodonga.
That's right. And if you look at his hair, his family owned the local Olympic pool. And that hair is not natural. It's a product of chlorine bleaching from doing lamps.
Don't be bitchy.
I'm sorry. The truth had to come out.
I know you got a bit pissed that you didn't think you were getting enough remuneration from the...
I think that in showbiz, as you well know, the rooms can never contain the egos. But all that's behind us. It was all just silly.
One of the things that you and Richard plug into is that great Australian tradition of the larrikin. Now, even the word has evaporated from the lexicon now, hasn't it?
My first book was a larrikin's memoir. It was called, they tried to call it a larrikin's memoir, which is a great Australian word because it is a great Australian tradition. But I called it Precious Bodily Fluids in the end because... that was a quote from Dr. Strangelove about fluidation.
We all recognise the origin of that quote.
Well, it was predictable in the book because the backdrop of my book was that Albury had a referendum on whether to put fluoride in the water or not and voted 9-1 against it because it was obviously communism. And Cleaver Bunton was mayor, but he was neutral on it. But we all know that it rots. It rots... everything that it touches.
What's your attitude to the law? Do you see it as a science, an art form, theatre, justice?
I've been trying to get out of law since I started. I'm not going to do it when I grow up, that's for sure. But I'm like a pelican in an oil spill. You know, I'm doing flapping my wings to try and get out. I'm like Al Pacino.
They keep dragging you back.
Like Al Pacino in The Godfather, they drag me back in. But I've been luxury. I had a bit of a luxury because when I graduated in law, I hated law and wanted to do it. So I taught law. I lectured at New South Wales Uni. And then a family you might not remember, but you might, Philip, called the Bartons, came back from South America. They were the Scaces of their time, but came back to face the music with $100 million that was allegedly stolen. And they tempted me out of academia. And I went into the bar, which was...
Everyone tells me you're very good at it.
No, that's a rumour I'm spreading. And
it's not true.
Not true, unfortunately.
So you wouldn't save Pistorius, you'd probably sink him.
Well, I'd be... No, I'd skate through a bit like him. I certainly wouldn't have him crying as much as he is. But he's got a tale to tell. I mean, he's obviously got a short fuse, as short men do, if you noticed. But if you had no legs, you would have a short man's fuse. But he's a fascinating, great case to do.
It isn't important, it isn't necessary, perhaps it isn't even desirable for you to like a client.
No, not at all. But you've got to know a client, and you can't read a client by reading the paperwork. You've got to sit with them by osmosis and get their feel. And that's one of the things you have to go do is to go to jail, which is the most miserable and saddest place on earth, and spend quality time between bars and go through 14 gates to see them, because it's 99% instinct law, you know, criminal law. It's 99% knowing the client and knowing what makes him tick.
Suddenly, I'm transported back to a very early meeting of the Australia Council. So this is, you know, 1971, two, something like that. And I'm taken aside by a lovely guy, a barrister, who thinks I'm not handling myself well in meetings. And he says, look, you've got to learn a few tricks. He said, I want you to say after me, with great respect. And he said, if you think the person opposite is an absolute deal, you can embellish it a little with very great respect. And he said, then you say what you want to say. And he mentored me for some months, and I liked him a lot. And I asked him why he'd never become a judge. And he said, I could not, under any circumstances, send anyone to jail for any reason.
I'm afraid I'm exactly the same. So I couldn't administer justice to anyone, because I prosecuted one case in my entire life, Harry Miller. I cried when he went to jail.
Well, Harry was an old mate of mine as well, but yes.
And so I cried when he went to jail. I thought, this is not in me. I'm a defender.
Yeah, but he used to ring me up from jail and negotiate Graham Kennedy's contract for a movie.
He is the very definition of a lovable rogue. I knew Patrick White pretty well then, who hated Harry because Harry had brought up the rights of...
Of Voss.
And yeah. So Patrick, knowing that I was prosecuting Harry, was, you know, befriended me and took me to dinners and loved me immensely because I was getting Harry his gumption. And inevitably, I fell out with Patrick, as everyone did. And but I came to admire Harry very much.
Patrick was an incredibly snooty moralist on many issues,
but
wasn't he?
I'm very soft on him because I was down and out. They'd asked me whether I wanted my scholarship one year in one lump sum of 2,000 or fortnightly. I took it 2,000, lost it at the casino, and had nowhere to stay, and two girls who were minding Patrick's house for 6 months while he was overseas took me in, and I was introduced to the world of arts and letters, and I slept in his bed and I slept in his pyjamas.
Is that, I know how some people get radicalised, is that how you became artified?
Exactly, that's how I was introduced to the arts. I'd never read a book, and I'd never seen art properly. You know, growing up in the pub, all I'd seen was that Indonesian woman, the green Indonesian woman. And
Trenchikov paintings.
Yeah, that's it.
Barry Humphries is a great authority on Trenchikov.
Well, exactly.
Paintings.
And then so suddenly I became part of Eastern Suburbs society and met artists and writers, and I loved them. And especially I Jewish writers and Jewish artists and the Jewish people of eastern suburbs, and I felt that I had been abandoned at birth and left in Albury, and I was obviously Jewish, and I found my chosen people, and it was a great change in me. It certainly changed my life.
One thing about you which never seems to have changed is you have, and I'm not going to say an insatiable lust, an absolute love of women.
Yeah, I think it's addictions. One of the addictions that I could keep up without it killing me, although I'm getting
damn near killed you when with Kate Fitzpatrick. Didn't
yeah, it? That was a long piece where someone like myself, who fancies themselves as a cross examiner, ends up 6 weeks in, you know, the box in being cross examined about a love affair that finished 20 years earlier.
But that's one of the things I like about Rake. He may be. He may be very naughty, but it's all goodwill. He falls in love so often. He projects qualities onto women that they often don't really have.
Well, yeah, no, that's exactly right. We're both great romantics, and we love women, and we do everything to excess. Cleaver loved the owner or the worker at the brothel, and I think it's classless. Cleaver and I share a classless lust. Of women, no matter where they come from, no matter what their background.
Have you had your heart broken very often?
Even last year, as a baby boomer like you, Philip.
No, I'm older.
I tried to flatter you.
Baby yeah. Booming.
Well, anyway, I made the mistake of falling in love with a Gen Y, and I think I proved that baby boomer does not go into Gen Y like, you know, in mathematics. But, yeah, no, I'm still... it's fascinating. It's wonderful.
I want to go back to you and the law. We've both agreed it's awfully hard to send people to prison. My barrister, who died very young shortly thereafter, made the point he could never distinguish the criminal from the cop, which has become painfully apparent.
Oh, very, very much. And they all came out in the same boat, if you remember, in the First Fleet and thereafter. Very hard to distinguish the warders from the criminals.
Nonetheless, there is within your character and within Rake, within Cleaver, a great desire to see rough justice done, to see in a way decency triumph.
You know what, I think we both share the opinion that there are more than 50 shades of grey, and behind every behind every crime is a person, and there's a reason, and there's a sympathetic reason, and we try to tease it out. And
I was confessing the other day to my long friendship with Billy Longley, the Texan. One of the most charming, lovable people I've ever known, and yet think of all the people he put in the river.
I know, and I've met fabulous people in my life, and the most loyal and the most loving and the most tenacious and fabulous people. And I share, I think, with my father, because he was a publican of a working class hotel, is that the people come in all shapes and sizes, but they've all, you know, got one thing in common: humanity.
I remember when I first met Longley in H Division, he came out, I'd never heard it before, I realised later it was a cliche, but he said, never judge a bloke unless you've walked a mile in his shoes. That's one thing that you do, you don't judge them.
I think, yeah, but it's not something I deliberately do. I just think it's part of my nature that I was either lucky enough to grow up in a classless sort of working class pub where I would invite boys home to have a lemonade at the end of school, and they'd say, oh, we're not going there. Mum says, my mother says the sawdust is 6 inches thick with blood. And it was a bit of a blood house. So I think I saw people as all equal. And the irony is the person in the next, we had the hotel next to the railway, and the person who lived in a tent next door was Dennis Richardson, who became the ambassador to America, and he lived in a tent and came from there to head of ASIO, to head of ASIS now. And
given your immense tolerance for human variety, can you hate? We've established that you can love.
No, I don't think I can, frankly, and it's something that I can see drives a lot of people But I've never been capable of hate. In fact, you know, I have great reason, and people sometimes do take against me. I don't hate anyone. I can't.
You'd hate bad ideas. You'd hate bigotry, for example.
Oh, absolutely. I hate the idea. I don't hate the person that says it, and I don't hate the person that. I hate the crime, but the person who did the crime has usually got an excuse, usually got something to say. It's a funny thing. I'm fascinated. I'm a people perv. I just sit and watch. I love watching people in situations. I love sitting around and watching the jury. You know, it's just an endless fascination. And thinking, we get a choice of how to pick jurors, and what would you know? We get three choices. How would you know what a person's good or bad? Your gut instinct. And the same, in, you know, I sit and watch in coffee shops, as many of us do in our dottery, and I'm endlessly fascinated. I could sit there for weeks and days.
I like your view about classlessness. Now, both of us know a lot of very famous and powerful people, and they're just as vulnerable,
yeah,
and just as human, and just as lost in many ways as anyone else.
That was a great insight when I was living at Patrick's. They were, you know, they were just the same as us. I met a large amount of celebrities, and they were just, you know, ordinary people with the same ordinary problems, and probably a little bit more ordinary in some cases.
Yeah, yeah.
Because some people become famous through hunger and ambitions and sheer drive who don't necessarily reflect that in their personality. But I wish I had a bit more ambition and drive.
Tell me about one of your real cases as opposed to a rape case. Tell me one that you recall and had a special value on.
Well, I noticed, unrehearsed in this, I did two cases last year where I had the unusual problem of defending innocent people, which is people...
Almost unheard of.
Unheard of, but yeah. When you're... Rake and I share the Rake character and I share this great thing, and that is we love cases that are unwinnable. So when everyone says you can't win them, that's exactly what we want to do. We want to take the unwinnable and pull the rabbit out of the hat. But because psychologically you're on the odds to nothing. You're not really carrying the burden of that person's destiny to a degree because it's unwinnable, but you are. But what's really difficult is when the person you know is completely innocent and yet the prosecutor and the entire brunt of state are against you and you know your client's innocent. That's when it's hard.
I find it impossible to think of you as a prosecutor.
Well, that's what I said. I was hopeless with Harry and I just couldn't do it. It's not in my DNA. But last year I had I defended a trotting driver charged with... Australia's greatest trotting driver, charged with corruption, but you knew he was innocent, and yet there was so much against you, and his whole life and his family's whole life depended on it, and it gives you a burden more than any other because you've got someone who's innocent, and you get a lot of sexual assault cases now where there's so much more prosecutions. Doesn't mean there's more going on. It just means that the police are under obligations to virtually prosecute every allegation, and that brings with it a lot of burdens.
We did a program last night on the long history of royal commissions into trade unions and indeed the labour movement. They go back until the late 19th century.
I know.
Do you think, it was put to me last night very passionately by an academic from the Catholic University in Canberra, that in fact most royal commissions are efficacious, honourable, and not fundamentally politicised.
Yeah, royal commissions are to deflect the attention away from the issue that they are investigating. If you study ICAC investigations, there's virtually no successful prosecutions after the event. That very rarely do you get a successful prosecution after an ICAC investigation. And the same with royal commissions. The royal commissions are entertaining, fabulous, especially if you've got Rupert Murdoch and his son, and I loved the whole drama and circus of it. But it's really just going through the motions in a real world. Nothing changes. Except, and I do think the current prosecution in England is a case I'd like to do, where you've got the red-headed Miss Brooks with her old lover Andy Coulson sitting in the dock together. I just think that's great theatre.
Rake ended, this series ended with Cleaver tangled up in a rope being lifted aloft by a great big glowing balloon. Where is the balloon of life going to lift you, take you next?
Well, I think a lot of barristers are said to be full of hot air, and I think that symbol was used to see where we're going to go. If you recall the last series, Cleaver was on his haunches about to be a victim certain prison rituals, but he seems to have turned that around. And now there's no plans for him to come back, but I think he's...
Oh, he's got to come back. We can't live without him.
I can't live without him.
Well, bugger you. There's all of us. We desperately need to... Because what he does is he embodies so much that we admire in this funny mongrel society.
Richard is 99% responsible for that. He's just such a great actor and created such a great character. And Peter Duncan, the other creator of the series, has gathered around him a lot of fabulous talent. And we all love it and love doing it. And some of the cases that we covered in it, the most unbelievable cases, are all true.
It's great to meet you after all these years. I wish we had twice or thrice the time, but good on you, Charles Ward Street. Love your columns. Do you write them or dictate them?
I handwrite them.
You handwrite them?
No, I'm afraid. I think at the rate of handwriting, and I just can't learn to do it. I'm getting dragon, but it's an excuse to have interns in to, translate them.
Yes, okay, no comment. Charles, barrister, filmmaker, actor, inspiration for Rake, and that's our lot for today. On our next, this you'll love this, Charles, desire, ambition, love and passion. An entire program-length discussion about Napoleon Bonaparte's wife, Empress Josephine. And there's much about Josephine you don't know, and we'll be delighted to discover. It's time to stick around on RN for the news. And I will see you later.